Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more. Today's program.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leti Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to this show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Leti. When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. So I'm out and abouting having the very conversations that you hear here and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. We'll get a taste of Korea and San Francisco and Tanzania and Pakistan and Apulia on today's jam-packed episode of Word of Mouth. First off, at the Green Market just this morning, we give springtime, the warm kind of spring, a warm welcome, and we'll give Ramps a foodie huzzah with Chef Aaliyah Lee Kong. And then in a few minutes, live in the studio, we'll welcome the James Beard Award-winning Corey Lee of Bennu and Manzur Benjamin, the Asianish American fine dining restaurant Bennu, in 2014, won 3 stars for Michelin, which is just about the highest culinary accolade in all of the land. We'll talk Seoul. You know, the one in South Korea, not the other kind. But he's got a lot of the other kind, too. Mom, pottery, porridge, sea cucumbers, and working with mentor Thomas Keller. State at end, because to wind it down, we'll get a little 101 on Apulia wine and beautiful, such a beautiful part of Italy, one of my favorites, with Mauro DiMaggio of Cantino San Marzano Winery. So let's go to the Green Market. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Aaliyah Lee Kong, chef and cookbook author. Hey, Aaliyah.
Hey, how are you?
So good. It is warm.
It is very warm. And we're standing here in front of Windfall Farms, which is awesome. Awesome. We're in the shade.
They've got some of the first ramps of the season.
Yeah, they have beautiful spring veg over here and greens, and these ramps are gorgeous. They have these sustainably sourced ramps, which we just learned about, which is really awesome, where it's just the leaves and they're triple washed already, so they're ready to go. And I'm definitely stealing one of these little $5 baskets on the way out.
Yeah, this is the time. The time is now, and I'm kind of missing the white parts.
Yeah, I am too, but they have these wild onions and spring garlic, so I'll just kind of mix it all up together and pretend.
Because we're all about alliums.
All about alliums.
So, what is your background?
My mom is Indo-Pakistani, and my father is from Tanzania and East Africa.
Whoa.
So, culturally, I'm all about alliums too.
Yes.
In every dish that I ever cook, it's garlic, onion. And ramps are awesome because they have both flavors in one.
I'm a little bit messed up in the kitchen given my love for alliums and garlic, and I can never tell when there's too much garlic because I'll eat garlic whole.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I will too. I think the only thing I don't like is when it's super raw.
Yep.
So it just gives me a headache.
Yeah.
So I like to roast garlic a lot. Mm. I use roasted garlic in pretty much everything. So I also don't know when there's too much garlic.
So what are you going to do with these ramps when you take them home?
So for me, ramps, I mean, they are just awesome, just chiffonade over everything, basically. I like to do them in, like, kind of a risotto, or one of my favorite things is kind of to roast poblanos and then do a puree with poblanos and ramps and a little bit of honey and some I keep these, like, pickled cherry peppers in my fridge 24/7, and I use the pickled cherry pepper juice, which I guess I could pickle them myself, but I love just pouring out a little bit into whatever I'm making. And it's just like an awesome pesto type of thing, sauce that goes right over like a nice grilled chicken breast or grilled chicken thighs, really is what I do.
Okay, so poblano pepper, ramps, and
a little honey, a little bit of garlic, but not as much because you have the ramps. And some pickled cherry juice.
Yeah, some kind of acidic element.
Yeah, and maybe one little pickled cherry pepper, too.
Mmm, just to puree
really
it up.
Yeah, and a little oil.
Over any kind of...
anything, fish, chicken, it's awesome.
That sounds
it's really
amazing.
Awesome. It's like a good grill accompaniment, you know? Like,
right.
Just kind of like drizzle. It's a drizzler.
Okay, so to go back to the chiffonade, let's define that for folks who have not had your experience in the kitchen.
It's just, it's kind of like almost like a julienne of a green leafy item.
Right.
So I just kind of roll it up.
Yep, so we roll it up
just like this.
We roll it up with
long
like,
ways.
Long ways. So right? Rolling it up as in the way that more rolls can be made, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like in the direction that more rolling can happen so that it's neater and thinner and prettier.
Yes.
Use a really sharp knife.
Use a really sharp knife and just do little fine chops. I mean, I like to cook them, but I also just really love ramps raw at this time of year because they just have incredible brightness to them, you know, on top of that garlic onion flavor. And I also do a lot of spring tarts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yay.
And yeah, with like whether it's goat cheese or whatever and just... Ramps go perfectly in them. And spring onions just baked right in, or asparagus baked right in with ramps. It's just perfect. And you know, the thing about ramps is they have such a short season, so the time is now.
It really is heartbreaking.
It is. It's so sad when it's over.
But then we got some good ideas today about how to preserve the presence of ramps in our lives, which to make a pesto out of it and freeze it.
Yeah.
And then that way we can bust it out later in the summer if we miss our ramp friends.
Definitely. And I might even blanch them first before making the pesto and then freezing them, because then it'll just preserve that bright green color too. So that's like a quick dip in boiling water and then ice it just to like shock it, like not even for that long.
Interesting.
That'll soften it up a little bit so you can use some of the tougher bits. And, you know, it'll just keep that beautiful color when you pull it out in the middle of summer.
And another idea is to pickle them.
Oh, yeah. I love pickled ramps, but I like pickled ramps with the bottom parts.
Yeah.
Because that's like my favorite. And then you just like chop it all up and mix it with mayo and slather it on your sandwich and you're like good to go.
When you're picking ramps, is there ever a bad ramp?
Because
they're usually pretty nice looking.
Yeah, I've never picked a bad ramp. I think more what I've done is not wash them appropriately like everybody else. And I think the biggest thing is like getting rid of that grit, because you don't want to be enjoying something and then just get that sandiness. That's like the worst.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And where can we find your book?
Oh, my book is at Barnes & Noble's. It's online on Amazon.
What is it called?
It's called Exotic Table. Exotic Table.
It's so exotic that you can't pronounce
it. Exactly. Exotic Table. And it's everywhere. And you can link from my site, AaliyahLeeKong.com, and grab it from there.
So ramps and exotic foods from your very colorful background.
I mean, stir fry.
Aside, like, what is your, you know, cooking vision? What do you hope people will take away from you and your book?
You know, I think the thing is that when you come from a multicultural background, but you're so kind of immersed in American culture, it's inevitable that the two are going to blend and bleed through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what my cooking is about. You know, I mentioned to you my husband's family's from Trinidad, but has, you know, Venezuelan and Chinese backgrounds to them. So it's, for me, I cook for my daughter. I cook everything. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's a lot of what's going to happen. And I travel and I learn and I cook. And I think bringing those flavors and cultures into your everyday eating is just an inevitability. And that's what I want people to take.
Of today, living in New York City.
Exactly, living in New York City.
Thank you so much, Aaliyah.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leyte Su, LEITIHSU, at Heritage_radio. And then, as always, hashtag WOMSHOW, which is short for Word of Mouth, WOMSHOW. And by the way, you can get this show anytime, anywhere, not just live, from the comfort of your own subway car, on iTunes, and please do rate the show if you love it, and then if you hate it, don't rate it. Okay, so with that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Chef and owner Corey Lee of the 3-Michelin-starred Bennu restaurant in San Francisco, and he's also got a French spot called Monsieur Benjamin. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Very good to have you. And we have before us some beautiful pizzas.
Yes, because quite a spread here.
You're getting the full Heritage Radio Network treatment. And what brings you here this trip?
Well, it's based around the release of our cookbook, Bennu, which just came out last week. And so I came here to talk to you and talk to some other people about the book and the process of writing it, and also to see some family. So that's kind of a nice bonus being in New York.
Oh, really? What family do you have who lives here?
My sister and her 3 kids. They live in Clinton Hill, so every time I'm in New York for work, I always try to steal a couple of days away where I can spend time with them.
Awesome. Yeah. So Bennu, no wonder I couldn't get my hands on a copy, because I have like the advanced like pamphlet from Phaidon.
You don't have a copy?
No.
Well, we'll get you one. Don't worry.
Yeah, but don't worry. I did all my online stalking of you before we got together in this in this studio environment. I feel like I know so much about you. There's not a lot about you online. You're not on social media.
No. Yeah, I'm not at all, actually. And, you know, people over the years have tried to get me on or put me on Twitter or Instagram. And I don't know. It's something I couldn't commit to. I feel like it's one of those things that if you're going to do it, you got to really do it all the way. And I just wasn't prepared to bring that into my life, you know.
Tell me what Bennu means.
Well, Bennu is an ancient word in Egyptian mythology that stands for the phoenix bird. And it also stands, as you know, for regeneration and long life. And so in the process of leaving the French Laundry where I was working before and living in Napa Valley and uprooting my life and the lives of people who came to join that team when we first opened, it was something that really resonated with us, this idea of starting something new and hopefully achieving longevity in the business. And then it's also something that's identifiable in many different cultures. The phoenix bird is something that's in Asia, in Africa, even in Europe. So there was something very international and inclusive about what it stood for. And then when you hear the word Bennu, it doesn't immediately place you in a certain part of the world. And I felt that was kind of important. You know, I didn't want this word that was French or Asian, and you heard it, you're like, ah, it's a Korean restaurant, or ah, it's a French restaurant.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it worked with the style of cooking that we're doing.
Wow. And speaking of the phoenix bird being present all over the world, you really talk about porridge being present all over the world too, in many forms.
Yeah, I mean, porridge is definitely one of those universal dishes. Whether it's made from rice or corn or any other kind of grain. It's just one of those very comforting things that people have eaten out of pleasure or necessity in various forms all around the world since the beginning of time.
You were at the French Laundry for, 7 years?
Yes, I worked at the French Laundry for 8 years. And then at Per Se for about a year during the opening to help with that.
It must have been a lot of different feelings embarking on your own.
There was a lot involved in leaving that very cosseted environment of the French Laundry in Napa Valley and starting a new business at that time, which was, I left in 2009, so it was kind of a shaky time for everyone, in restaurants in particular, and certainly ambitious restaurants. So it was unnerving, but at the same time, I felt like once I decided it was time to try, there was no turning back. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of all in on that.
I really enjoy your food because you're using all of these Asian ingredients that I don't think I've actually seen anywhere else except for like in the Asian restaurant in my suburb of Cerritos, California, where I grew up, like sea cucumber.
Sea cucumber. We use a lot of dried ingredients, whether it's dried abalone, dried scallops. Even some mushrooms and fungi that are dried, dried oysters. There's this entire pantry of Asian ingredients that I think that are really underexplored in certainly Western dining, but just in haute cuisine.
And also 1,000-year-old egg.
Yeah, 1,000, you know, the pidan or 1,000-year-old egg or 100-year-old egg. That's actually how we've started the menu at Benu since we opened. Yeah.
Wow.
It's one of those just kind of very challenging things. I mean, certainly
it's
for
a hard
lot
sell.
Of, well, you know, I mean, for a lot of people, and a lot of those people are our diners. It's a very comforting thing, but it's also made out of a quail egg, which is which I've never seen before. And over the years, I've come to realize why no one does them with quail eggs, because they're actually very tricky to do. But
yeah, how do they make that? It's a 110-year-old quail egg. The exact egg you use?
Yeah, so it's basically a base cooked egg, meaning the pH is very high and it denatures the proteins, and then it forms a gel eventually. And that's the premise behind the 1,000-year-old egg. And because it's high in pH, it also becomes preserved. It's almost the opposite thing of like putting something in something that's very acidic and using that to not only cook it, but to preserve it.
Right. Yeah. Because that environment is too... It's terrifying for bacteria.
Oh, exactly. But I mean, for those who've never had it before, you know, this brown, wobbly,
gelatinous,
eggshell, so, yeah,
funky,
yeah,
earthy.
Right, exactly. But you know, it puts you to the test right away. I mean, I think that our diners hopefully come looking to try something new or something different, and hopefully something that's only served in our restaurant. And it puts them to the test right away, whether they're in the right restaurant or not.
A couple of weeks ago, I ran into a dude who grows sea cucumber in Nicaragua. And apparently, it's when done right, it's sustainable and also it's profitable, because it's like one of those luxury fine dining ingredients that, you know, China certainly demands. Is there hope for sea cucumber in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there's... A place for ingredients that are very texturally based, and certainly sea cucumber is one of them. But I look around and I see a lot of foods that Westerners or Americans or Europeans love, things like braised pork skin or you know, different cuts of beef that have a lot of collagen and gelatin in them, and they're very similar to the texture of sea cucumber. And then if you were to braise them in some kind of, you know, delicious, intense, very savory sauce, I think it'll mimic very much those kind of long braised meats.
Mm-hmm. Hooray. Okay. And I'm about to, like, do my thing where I corner you and ask you about Taiwanese food, because,
okay,
wow, we have here a chef who of high repute who understands Asian cuisines and Asian ingredients. So... You've been to Taiwan before, right?
I have. I was there a couple years ago for an event, but I've been a fan of Taiwanese food for a long time. And suddenly living in California, mm-hmm. I've been able to, you know, experience some Taiwanese cuisine even before my visit. But I think with all kinds of foods, learning a little bit about the history of a country and their culture really gives you a deeper understanding of their food traditions and why they eat certain things and why it's unique. And Taiwan is certainly no exception. I think so much of Taiwanese cuisine is a reflection of its history, whether it's the Chinese moving there during the Cultural Revolution, mm-hmm. or its occupation by Japan. And you still see those things, and you see the result of that time. And in that, it's become a very interesting cuisine. I feel like it's some of the best example of even traditional Chinese cooking that you can find anywhere.
Yes.
There's this priority on vibrancy and freshness that you don't really see in other kinds of Chinese cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with the Japanese influence, you see a lot of that as well. I mean, it's a kind of cuisine that has some raw vegetables, even raw fish, that's kind of rare in Asian cooking. I think most things are cooked in Asian cooking. So in that sense, it's very unique, and I think it's very flavorful, bright, and different from the kind of food you're going to find anywhere else in Asia.
When you went there, what was your favorite dish or sort of experience? You actually mentioned that street food wasn't what you went straight for, which is what I go straight for.
Yeah, I mean, there's a range of different kinds of foods you can get in Taiwan, as you know. Certainly, there's the street food that it's famous for. I really enjoyed... some of the street food, the sticky tofu and things like that, certainly is an experience. But I really enjoyed the hot pot and the duck restaurants.
Mm.
I think that's something that's very special in Taiwan, where you go to these restaurants and it features a hot pot, and then there's just sausage or kind of tofu-like thing that's made from coagulated duck blood, and it's this very intense, rich, and savory experience that you have that I've had for the first time in Taiwan.
And the whole duck blood thing, that's so French, too. I feel like there could really be some French-Taiwanese interesting, I'm going to use the word, dirty word, fusion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not necessarily a dirty word. It depends how you use it. But yeah, I mean, Boudin Noir, you know, it's the same premise of taking blood and it coagulating and turning to this very sweet, savory, slightly irony dish. And it's the same process.
So that exact moment not too long ago when Michelin gave you a phone call, none of that stuff, that da-da-da, so surprising, blah, blah, blah. No, really, where were you standing? What were you doing? How did you guys, what was it all like? That, it's just crazy.
it was a pretty surreal moment. And every other year that we've gotten a call, it was the same person who called me, and I was in the same place, which is the kitchen of Bennu. And I heard her tell me that we had received 3 stars, and it didn't really sink in the first.
How do they, they're like, hi, how are you? Niceties.
Well, it always starts the same way, you know? So you never know what's coming, you know? They're like, we want to congratulate you on being included in this year's mission guide. And,
okay.
Yeah. Okay, so in what way are we included? No, but the thing is, when I started working in kitchens, Michelin didn't have a presence in the U.S.
Right, only until 2005, which is bonkers.
Yeah, so I grew up as a cook, viewing Michelin as this thing that was totally out of our reach as American chefs. And I traveled to Europe, worked in London, worked in Paris, and then stodged all around Europe, trying to get that Michelin experience. And so it was never even a goal for me.
Can I tell you something? It's kind of like me being the president of the United States. I grew up knowing that would never happen because I was not born here.
Right,
so
right. So
I'm
some of the things
now.
Change,
yeah.
and it happens. And, it's not something that you could aspire to achieve. So in that sense, it's still kind of surreal in some ways.
So, but what then? What did you say? Did you freak out? Did you cry? Well, I don't know.
it really sank in when I gathered all the staff in the kitchen. About half an hour later, it took me half an hour to just actually digest this information.
You go keep on julienning your veggies, or
yeah, what? I was just kind of walking around a little bit, and making sure the deliveries are coming, and just going about my day. And then I gather all the kitchen staff, and then I let them know, and seeing their reactions actually made it that much more emotional for me. Seeing the look on their faces, and knowing that they all felt that they were so much a part of it and they helped obtain something like that, made it really meaningful for me. And it was just this very special time and one that I'll certainly never forget.
So you're pushing the envelope. You used to be uncomfortable when at... uncomfortable is maybe a strong word, but at cocktail parties when people say, what kind of restaurant is Bennu? And you're like, well, it's this and it's that, and then sea cucumbers and thousand-year-old egg, and then you've come to be more comfortable with yourself and your food, I think, and with the word fusion. So what's happening, what's exciting in Asian-ish food in the country today?
Well, I think there's a lot of exciting things happening, and it's not just in Asian food. I mean, I think it's has to do with people's overall interest in food and restaurants increasing a lot in the past 5 to 10 years, maybe even longer. And that interest has allowed young chefs and young restaurateurs opportunities to open exciting places on a smaller budget. So you see just a larger and broader range of restaurants opening. So certainly Asian cuisine has benefited from that overall increase in people's interest.
We can be more specific with it.
Yeah, and take some risks.
Okay.
And take some risks with some degree of confidence that people out there will come to the restaurant and check it out. And I don't think without, certainly the public's interest, you would see those small restaurants opening. And there have been a lot of places that have opened that that it's nice to see there's an audience for that. And even, you know, we're here at Roberta's in Bushwick, and you know, they were one of the pioneers in coming out here and opening something like this. So this, in a lot of ways, you know, this this restaurant here exemplifies kind of what's been going on with food in America and what makes it exciting in New York.
So at a cocktail party, do you have different versions of how you describe menu for different people?
Yes, I actually
okay, so let's say
I've become pretty good at reading or gauging people's interest in how long of an explanation they want.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's tricky. I mean, and
so what are those different versions? Like, break it down for me.
Well, here's the thing. So I'm Asian American. You're Asian American, right?
And, huzzah!
And I remember, you know, when I was young, and I would go to like a friend's house or something, and you know, their parents would be like, "Hey, where are you from?" And I was always kind of like, "Huh? Well, you know, what does that mean? You know, like, where am I from? Am I from Korea? Like, or you know." And I feel the same way about when people ask what kind of food is served at Bennett, because for me it really is an expression of American cuisine in San Francisco. It's very specific geographically, and it represents San Francisco culturally.
Mm-hmm.
But it, ultimately, it's part of this American cuisine that's open to different cultures and the influence of different people, and it's constantly changing. So for me, it's an American cuisine that's happening in San Francisco right now.
And I love what you the stake in the ground that you put in your book, which is that while Bennu relies on access to the bounty of our era, that's not what inspires the cuisine. So it's really like the contrast between working at the French Laundry and having a farm to work from and just like bounty, bounty, bounty. Everyone talks about California bounty, woohoo. And then, but you're like, okay, this is an international city. Like, this is me and my very colorful background, which, by the way, you have a really...
Yeah, so, you know, of course, working as a chef in California, I mean, you get kind of spoiled. No, you do. And just working, you know, in modern times, I think, we have access to things that chefs of previous generations just simply didn't have access to. So in that sense, yes, all those things are really important and a big part of what we do at the restaurant. And being in California, being in Northern California, working in the Bay Area, we certainly tap into the resources that are available to us as chefs. But in terms of just what inspires us, what we're trying to achieve,
mm-hmm.
You know, those are the tools for what we do. But I think we aspire to create something that's unique to our restaurant, dishes or an experience that can only be had in our restaurant and in our restaurant in San Francisco. So I think we're looking to be inspired by the cultural makeup of the city, the influences, its history. And it's actually its history and its influences that led to this discovery of wonderful Chinese cuisine and some of its techniques and its ingredients.
You had an interesting... your family was sort of scattered around the globe.
Yeah. I mean, we were a family that moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. And my father worked for a large Korean company, so...
As an engineer,
mm-hmm. Yeah. A large construction company, construction company in Korea that had offices around the world. So he would go to the Middle East for a large project, like a factory was coming up, and he would be a project manager there or something. And then in the early 80s, they decided to try their luck in the American market, opened a branch office here in New York, and my father moved here to work there. And ultimately, it didn't work out, so they closed it, and he moved back. But in that process, he moved his entire family here, and then moved most of his family back, and I just kind of happened to stay around.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because you have two older sisters, and they started their schooling in South Korea, and then you sort of...
Yeah, so they were, they were a bit older. Mm-hmm. Than I was when they first moved here, so they went through the Korean educational system a little bit longer, so they had a better understanding of the language, and they went back and went to university in Korea, actually.
Mm.
But ultimately, they both came back here and mm-hmm. Did some graduate work and finished schooling here in New York, so it's gone full circle in many ways.
You came here when you were 5 years old.
Yeah, I came here when I was 5 years old, and that was an interesting age, because I think you're young enough where you're going to embrace your new surroundings as your home, and you don't feel like a visitor or a foreigner or an immigrant. But you're old enough that you have some memory of your native culture. And so it was kind of an interesting time. And certainly You know, if you're in a family that has immigrated to the U.S., I think trying to recreate some of the food traditions of your native culture is a big part of what you do as a family, whether it's on special occasions or looking for products that aren't available here and trying to recreate some of the dishes from your homeland. You realize that food is such an important part of life.
Your mom and dad provided you lobster with drawn butter for your birthday. And
are you sure you didn't read the book?
December. I got really crafty. I had to poke my head. Oh, wait, can I tell you what I did?
Yeah, sure.
I had to poke
sure.
my head into the Amazon previews.
Oh.
Yeah, I really had to dig things up.
I'll get you one.
So that's just hilarious. I mean, it's, I guess your parents are food lovers. I mean,
yeah.
What?
I look back and, I didn't think that my family were that into food, but actually they really were. And so much of what we did as a family revolved around trying a dish or cooking this very American thing or traveling somewhere to experience this restaurant or, something food related. And so I always thought that becoming a chef was this kind of accidental thing about being thrown into the industry because I needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
But I realize now that it's something that was cultivated for many years growing up in a family that had a lot of food experiences and traditions and experiences revolved around trying something.
Your mom is a potter, mm-hmm. was a potter, mm-hmm. or still does pottery.
Yeah, she was, I guess she hasn't done pottery in many years now, but she was a potter and she kept a wheel and it was something that that she did for a lot of things, a lot of reasons. One, she had an art history background.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was something that she could do while she was living in the States and something that she was very passionate about and also something that kept her connected to Korean culture because there's a long history of pottery in Korean culture. And so even now in my apartment at home and even at my parents' place in Korea, there's still pieces that she made when we were living in the U.S. together.
Mm-hmm. Does she actually make a living as a potter?
No, she actually made a living as an illustrator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she dabbled in a couple of different disciplines, but she actually worked as an illustrator and she would do patterns for textile companies and things like that. But she studied pottery and she did pottery because she had a passion for it.
What did your Asian parents think of you becoming a chef?
Yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot by other Asians only, of course. Other people don't ask you that. They don't have the same empathy. But I think my mother wanted me to go a much more academic route. I have two older sisters who went that route.
Mm-hmm.
But my father, because he was a professional for a long time and really did the right things. He was a professional, worked for a big company in Korea, climbed that corporate ladder for many years. But in the late 90s, during the IMF in Korea, and the recession, his company went under. And so this company that he devoted his entire professional adult life to suddenly stopped existing.
Wow.
And he was kind of forced into early retirement, late 50s. So when I wanted to be a chef and he found out, he really supported me, It was like I made all the choices that your mother probably wants for you, and look what happened to me. Just follow your passion and do what you're interested in, and don't have any regrets about it. So in that sense, he was very open minded, very liberal about it.
That's really rad. Yeah. Yeah, in my career, I've seen many companies rise and fall.
Yeah,
so it must be me.
So they were supportive.
Wow.
I mean, really, ultimately, they were supportive.
So when they came into Bennu for the first time, what was that? Was that the friends and family? What was that like?
Yeah, so that was the first time. I mean, by the time Bennu opened, I've been working in restaurants for over 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time they came to eat at a restaurant where I worked.
What?
Yeah. They never wanted to come in and
what?
Eat. Yeah, they were like, we don't want to eat while our son's in the kitchen.
That's so Asian.
Away. Yeah, it really is. But it was just this very special moment for them to come and kind of experience this thing that I've been working on. Really almost my entire life, and My mother also did some designs for our pottery at Bennu, and to see that in the context of the restaurant was very special for her. So it's just this really great time for them and for me as well.
Do they, like, understand what three Michelin stars really means? Like, do they feel that in their heart?
You know, I don't think they know enough about its history and tradition to kind of understand it. I think they get that that's the highest rating that Michelin offers.
Okay.
and like, you know, like a lot of Asian parents, like, oh, you gotta, if you're gonna do this, you gotta get three stars. Like, mom, it doesn't work that way.
Your mom's like, is there four stars? Is there four stars? Is there extra credit?
Yeah. No, but you know, they've certainly become more aware of the kind of this restaurant industry and the world of fine dining and just people's relationship with food, and that's different from theirs. You know, they've become much more aware of eating traditions outside of what they're comfortable with and outside of Korea. And it's been a fun journey for them as well.
You worked with Thomas Keller for a long time.
Yeah.
What's your most memorable story with Chef Keller in or out of the kitchen?
Oh, man, there's been so many. And, you know, I spent my 20s there, so in some ways I feel like I became an adult in an environment that that he cultivated or he created. So in that sense, he was this great figure in my life and my true mentor. And we've become, our relationship changed over the years. You know, it started as a chef and cook and employer and employee. Then it went to a chef owner and his chef de cuisine. And then he went to great friends, and he went to golfing buddies, and
wow.
And now, you know, I do see him less than I would like to, but we're still very close, and you know, we text each other and we email each other just to kind of stay connected and stay in touch.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with our busy schedule, sometimes it's really hard to get some FaceTime and spend some time together. But we still manage to meet up once in a while, and you know, maybe play a bad round of golf here and there.
Yeah, who's the better golfer?
Oh, I am by far. So, but I'll see him tonight, and I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
So, your dream job if you weren't a chef?
Yeah, so I think that's changed over the years. You know, I think when I was younger for a long time, my dream was to be a professional tennis player. And I played tennis competitively and traveled around the country to do that. And I think I found out at about the age of 12 that short Asian guys really can't be professional tennis players. and so that was kind of a crushing blow to me.
You're Asian?
Yeah. So yeah, apparently Koreans aren't the best tennis players. But that's kind of when I gave up on all my my athletic kind of aspirations, you know. But there's something about competing and doing something that really tested your potential, and tested your limits, that I really liked, and that's why I like sports.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, as I played some team sports, there was that sense of camaraderie and everyone being in it together and really pushing each other to excel. That was really amazing, and I feel like I find both those things as a chef. And then now, if you were to ask me what would I be doing if I wasn't a chef, it might be something like maybe something like architecture, something that because it's related, because you know, architecture and food, I mean, they're both necessities, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need shelter, we need food. These are basic human needs. But how you address those things and how you offer those things, that really defines who we are and what kind of society we are.
Yeah, otherwise we'd be in like a cave.
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
Making a fire.
Yeah, I mean, meeting your basic needs are important, of course, but meeting them in beautiful ways and interesting ways, I mean, that's what makes life worth living for. So in that sense, I feel like they're very related, and I enjoy different kinds of architecture and chewing architects' head off about different designs and things like that.
My last question for you is coming from Instagram.
Instagram, what's that?
I can't wait to see you on a social media, by the way. It's going to happen. Don't worry about it. I'll help you. So many fine dining ingredients. This is from Erin_Fairbanks. She had a question for us. So many fine dining ingredients are literally disappearing or threatened. And so what's the role of chefs here?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually very scary what's going on. I think about when I started cooking in 1995, and all the things that were plentiful, and we just used almost irresponsibly, whether it's wild caviar, which you can't get anymore, bluefin tuna, all different kinds of fish that were just so plentiful, and I can't even find them. It's like, what happened? And things are disappearing before our eyes, and it's very scary. And I think that we as chefs need to be more responsible, but the only way that's going to happen is through consumer demand. I feel like diners and consumers need to demand that of their chefs. And that's the only way that as a movement it can happen. Because ultimately, you know, we're people who are providing service to a consumer, and we want to meet that demand in the way they expect. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts with education, mm-hmm. But it has to be demanded by the consumer.
Thank you so much, Corey.
Thank you. Great to be
coming
here.
Coming in. And that was just Corey Lee of Bennu and Monsieur Benjamin in San Francisco. With just a little bit of time left to wind it down, we have Mauro DiMaggio of Cantina San Martino in Apulia, Italy. So stay close for that after this quick commercial break.
Book a farm escape. Escapemaker.com, a guide to local getaways, is offering a two-night farm escape that includes lodging, a visit to an apiary, wine tasting at a vineyard, and a special tour of Bobolink Dairy and Bakehouse in Milford, New Jersey. Transportation is included. For details, visit escapemaker.com or come by the Bobolink Dairy stand at the new open-air Fulton Stall Market on Front Street in the South Street Seaport District. Located where New York City's public food markets began in the 1800s, Fulton Stall Market is open weekends 10 to 5 and is the first farmers market in the city to offer ready-to-eat foods made by the farmers who produce them, along with a radio station, live music, and cooking workshops for families. Now offering spring flowers and plants, organic vegetables, pizza made in a wood-burning oven using farm ingredients, local fruit preserves, yogurts, and ice cream, and Bobolink Dairy's famous artisanal cheese and breads. The market is a great reason to rediscover the authentic seaport. For more information, visit FultonStallMarket.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. And today, to wind it down, we've got Mauro DiMaggio from Cantina San Marzano in one of my favorite regions in Italy, Apulia. Hello, Mauro.
Hello, Leti. How are you?
Good. You sound not that far away, but you're very far away.
can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you great. So, let's talk Puglia. To start, for folks who are not familiar with the region, the climate, the typical grapes planted, can you share with us a little primer?
Yeah, Puglia is in the center of the Mediterranean Sea, so we are the southeastern region of Italy. And it's, let's say, the heel of the boot. It's a very thin strip of land between two seas, the Ionian Sea and the Adriatic Sea. And it's a very sunny place, so it's very nice in summertime. And actually, it's a region naturally done for tourism and food and wine production. We have a lot of nice fruit, nice green stuff to eat, like salads, nice dairy products. So Puglia is quite well known in Europe and in Asia for its lifestyle, because it's in between two seas, mm-hmm. with a nice climate, warm climate, and very nice product to eat and drink.
So what are the typical grapes planted?
Well, the most important grapes are, above all, Negro Amaro, and the most important one is Primitivo, which is genetically linked to your Zinfandel. They are the same from the DNA point of view. So it's these two grapes, Negramaro and Primitivo, are two big reds with a very nice red fruit aromas and a nice body, very round and appealing.
I feel like in the last couple of years, Apulia has been touted as one of the sort of still yet not super discovered regions in the world to visit. And you mentioned Europe and Asia is noticing this, and then now more and more the United States. As the general manager of Santina San Marzano, what have you noticed in terms of the wine and tourism market?
Well, in terms of tourism, there is a very strong interest towards Puglia. This region is growing very fast. A lot of people is coming here. As I told you, it's very warm here, so for 6-7 months of the year, it's very nice to stay here. And there is, together with the tourism, because of the interest towards our food and wine, many people are coming to visit our wineries, to know better our cuisine. In terms of architecture, Puglia is is the oriental part of Italy, so is looking to the eastern part of Europe, and you can see in his buildings and his nice cities, very in his white nice cities, you have many points of interest, which makes Puglia a very nice region to go to in order to know his culture, to eat his food, to drink his wine. So generally speaking, there's a growing interest towards Puglia.
So tell me one iconic Apulian dish and you know, the wine that you love to drink with it.
Well, I'd say orecchiette and cime di rape with anchovies. Well, orecchiette is a typical homemade pasta from Puglia with this vegetal sauce based on kind of broccoli rabe, mm-hmm. With some anchovies. This sauce gives a very strong taste to this pasta, some nice green taste with a little bit of bitterness and spiciness. And so I'd say that this dish is the perfect pairing for our big red, like a good Primitivo with some roundness, with some red fruits aroma. So I think it's the perfect pairing to think about in Puglia.
And I have to note here that the broccoli rabe sauce is it's actually smushed up into this beautifully green and vegetally sauce. It's not whole broccoli rabe. It's absolutely delicious. So yeah. my last question for you is here in, let's say, New York, because we have a lot of listeners in New York. What should we pick up in wine shops or at restaurants that that can teach us, show us a little something from Puglia?
Well, I would suggest, as in Puglia, the fruit is very good, and so the wine which comes from this fruit must be, from this grape, must be very fruity and rich in the palate. So I would suggest some Primitivo or Negramaro, to pick up some Primitivo Negramaro, and even in the whites, you can have Malvasia Bianca. Mm-hmm. These three grapes are all local, I mean autochthonous vine varieties, mm-hmm. And they express very well the best that you can get in Puglia, which is nice fruit, nice and pleasant body in your mouth, which go very well with a modern cuisine, let's say, with a lot of dish, spicy and rich.
Wow, thank you so much, Mauro, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Leyte.
We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today we had the chef and cookbook author Aliyah Lee Kong, Chef Corey Lee of the 3-Michelin-starred Bennu in San Francisco, and that was just Mauro DiMaggio, the GM of Cantina San Marzano in Apulia. I'm your host, Leyti. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Meep Show.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.